It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Sunday marks the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I. We'll find out about a rock concert in Madison that's doubling as a history lesson on Wisconsin's role in the conflict. Right now, there have been big developments in U.S. immigration policy over the past day. First, a federal appeals court upheld an injunction that blocked President Trump's decision to end DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That's the Obama-era plan that protects young undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children from being deported. This morning outside the White House, Trump responded to the ruling.
The good news is, by rejecting DACA in the Ninth Circuit yesterday, finally, we've been waiting for that. We get to the Supreme Court. And we want to be in the Supreme Court on DACA.
Then early today, Trump moved to deny asylum to migrants who enter the country through the U.S.-Mexico border. It comes as caravans of Central American migrants slowly make their way toward the U.S., but officials say it'll apply to anyone caught entering the United States illegally. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University at Buffalo. He's an expert in immigration law and policy and teaches a class on refugee and asylum law. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you.
Well, let's take these one at a time and start with DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Remind us of where we are and what this court ruling means.
Yeah, so essentially this is the first appeals court to uphold one of the many injunctions that have been levied against the rescission of DACA. And essentially the reasoning is the same that's been consistent in all these courts. Essentially, they are saying that the reason the Trump administration gave for rescinding DACA is arbitrary and capricious. And that's because the reason they gave was that DACA is unconstitutional and unlawful. And the courts, as a matter of law, says that's not the case, that actually you have the authority as the administration to implement DACA. So it's important to note that the ruling actually is kind of limited. It's not saying that the Trump administration cannot rescind DACA. It's just saying that the reason they gave for doing so in this case was arbitrary and therefore in violation of the law.
So what would be the next step then?
So the next step that the Trump administration seems to want to pursue, and as you saw her from the clip, seems to be eager for that, is Supreme Court review. There was a lot of discussion before of whether or not the Supreme Court was willing to take the case without having the appellate courts decide it. That was sort of bouncing around for a while. But now that given a appellate court has decided it, it seems to set it up for Supreme Court review. Now, of course, the irony of this is that actually there doesn't need to be a Supreme Court review if all Trump wanted to do was to rescind DACA. As these decisions have often said, if Trump just gives a good reason why he does not like DACA as a matter of policy, he can freely rescind it. But he seems to, it's not entirely clear, but maybe for political reasons, really want to actually tackle the legality of DACA to begin with at the Supreme Court level.
That, I guess, could set a precedent for a future president, I guess, to not bring DACA back after President Trump left office. Would that be one possible motivation?
Yeah, it seems to be potentially one motivation. Another one might be, at least on the political front, is that Trump seems to be at times a little bit of two minds about DACA. He definitely wants to challenge it, and he does not like it. On the other hand, it's not clear that politically, and this was his position when he first came to office, that he really wants to make that big of a case about the particular dreamers themselves, especially with regard to some of the congressional action that's been happening in this particular realm. So he seems to be skirting a fine line. Like I said, if he just gives a good policy reason why he's rescinding DACA, none of this litigation or injunctions would be here. On the other hand, it's interesting because if he does prevail at the Supreme Court level, and that's not necessarily certain, given that all the courts have come out against his actions, it would presumably limit his own presidential powers to some degree, because ultimately the DACA decision is about the power of the president to exercise his discretion to not enforce particular areas of the immigration law if they feel that the resources or priorities do not justify that.
So the outcome, though, if the Supreme Court said, yes, President Trump was in the right, he can rescind DACA, that would mean hundreds of thousands of people who had been brought into the United States undocumented as children would be subject to deportation right away. Is that right?
That would be correct. Now, it would be a way to be seen, given that this is just saying that he has the executive ability to do so, whether or not he will restore, again, some of the sort of phase-out provisions that was in the original DACA. Now, those have already passed. He might decide to do so again, just sort of for proper administration. But theoretically, the day the opinion comes out, then DACA could be immediately rescinded. All the phase-out provisions have already been completed, and deportations can begin immediately if that's to be the case. I would suspect, though, that if that were to happen, that we would get some more murmurings in Congress about whether or not they want to deal with it.
Right. If I recall correctly, I want to jump in there. President Trump, when he said, "I want to rescind DACA," part of what he said was in order to get Congress to take action on this and do it the right way. That was one of the statements he made, yet still hasn't happened.
Yeah. So the right way is sort of interesting, and this gets back a little bit, I think, to the politics of it. I do think that in some ways President Trump is concerned about DACA specifically, but I think also that President Trump is concerned about DACA to the degree that he could use it to leverage other immigration priorities. He's kind of bounced back and forth on whether he actually supported a congressional action on it or not, and ultimately what would happen is he wanted to leverage DACA into a broader restriction on immigration and funding for the border wall. So I suspect that in some ways what he wants here is to set up more political leverage so that he can achieve his other priorities in exchange for legalization of the status of Dreamers.
Law professor Rick Sue is with us from the University at Buffalo, talking about two big pieces of immigration news. A court ruling on DACA was part one, and now we have asylum law, the Trump administration saying that asylum laws won't apply to people coming from Central America through Mexico who try to enter the country illegally. Here's a listen to him talking about this.
We want people to come into our country, but they have to come into our country legally. They have to come into our country legally. We want people to come in through the merit system so that they can work for all of these great companies that I have coming into our country.
Break down what's going on here for us, Rick.
So there seems to be two things. One is the statements in his actual proclamation about asylum and essentially his desire to limit it to individuals who do not arrive at a port of entry. In other words, individuals who sneak into the country and then claim for asylum from the southern border, he wants to say those people are categorically barred, at least for 90 days and potentially with extensions from applying for asylum. Though there seems to be something else going on as well, which is not necessarily about whether or not people can apply for asylum by following the right procedure, his proclamation says, going to a port of entry, but whether or not he actually believes in asylum law as well, given that he talks about the legal manner of coming to the United States is through the merit system or something along those lines. And this becomes a little problematic because, of course, asylum is the law. It's also encoded in international obligations. So it's not entirely clear whether or not this is just an exercise of discretion in some regards, whether or not this is some way of challenging the legal system entirely, including the current Immigration Naturalization Act.
And the ACLU is suing the Trump administration. It was assumed that there would be legal challenges here. So a whole new court process starting, I guess. What do you watch for there?
Yeah, this is going to be big. And I think in some ways, I think what the Trump administration is doing with the proclamation is trying to piggyback off of the travel ban, which ultimately in the third version was upheld by the Supreme Court. And that's the power that he's invoking, right? The power to suspend entry of individuals that would be a detriment to the United States. The problem, however, is the way he's using it here seems to conflict not only with various other aspects of law, but it's not also clear that his suspension of entry necessarily affects asylum. So it's likely to see there's going to be a litigation on this and clarifying, especially with regard to the conflicts that this seems to have produced with what he's trying to do as an executive and what Congress has passed in terms of the laws.
A lot going on. Again, hope for action in Congress. But on CNN, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois wasn't very optimistic. Here's a listen.
He's virtually impossible to bargain with, particularly on the issue of immigration. He has people around him who are very hateful, and they unfortunately color his judgment.
He there being President Trump. Do you see in this new term with Democrats controlling the House now any likelihood of compromise agreements on immigration?
I'm not sure. I think there are definitely certain things that Donald Trump wants, and I think the border wall and limiting legal immigration are top of the list. They certainly were in the last negotiation about Dreamers, but those seem to be lines that Congress and certainly the Democratic Party don't feel that we easily sort of cave on, especially on the restrictions of legal immigration. So I think that the political process is going to go forward. And in some ways, the legal battles are all the more important, right? Because what we're determining here, much like what Obama did, is how much can the president do without Congress? And in some ways, some of his recent action, especially with the asylum ban, seems to actually specifically go against Congress. So there is a big concern about separation of powers and checks and balances. The only question is whether or not Congress is actually going to stand their ground.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University at Buffalo. He's an expert in immigration law and policy and teaches a class on refugee and asylum law. We talked with him about the ongoing legal battle over DACA and President Trump's move to deny asylum to migrants who entered the U.S. illegally. This Sunday marks the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War, and musicians and others in Madison are commemorating it with, among other things, a rock and roll history show. The program, called The Greatest War, uses songs, both new and old, along with images from the war. It's happening at 7 o'clock this Sunday at the Barrymore Theater in Madison. It's part of a month of events looking back at the war. Sean Michael Dargan is a big part of The Greatest War. He's a singer, songwriter, and band leader from Madison. He also happens to be married to the assistant director of our Ideas Network. Sean, thanks for being in the studio with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Also in the studio, John Wedge, co-producer of the show and member of the band The Periodicals. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks very much for having us.
So, John, why look back 100 years later at World War I?
Well, as you probably know, this is the 100th anniversary, the centenary, that's been celebrated in, or recognized, should I rather say, all over the world. And we wanted to do something here in Wisconsin to recognize it, to kind of acknowledge the significance of this, and really to talk about how it still impacts us today.
Right. Looking back at the outcomes of World War One, maps drawn in the Middle East that are still very much a live issue. Eastern Europe, the Balkans, elsewhere. This was a thing that shaped our world today.
Absolutely. And I think those of us that had relatives that we knew who were affected directly by this conflict too had very strong ideas about the war to end all wars, that this would be something that would never be repeated, that this would be something that was a defining moment in their lives and the lives of the generations to follow them. And we really want to look at their legacy, what they wanted, to make the world safe for democracy, and consider how we're doing with that.
Now, Sean, there's a lot of events happening to mark this 100th anniversary. The centerpiece of this series in Madison is this rock and roll history show on Sunday night. How does this tell the story of World War One?
Sure. This show is really the brainchild of our friend and colleague Ken Fitzsimmons, the leader of a band called The Kissers. He came up with the idea of A Greatest War as a silent film about 12 years ago. We worked on it for about a year and then put it on the shelf. It was going to have an original classical score to be played live in front of the silent film. It was reinvigorated in the last year by John and myself dragging Ken along with it because it was such a great idea. And it's no longer a classical piece. It's now four bands, a hip-hop band, a hip-hop polka band, non-ironic, amazing band from Milwaukee called November Criminals, a talented cat and his very cool period-flavored band called The Viper and his famous orchestra, also from Milwaukee. And then John and I will be singing our rock band thing, and the Kissers, of course, will be a big part of it. It's multimedia in the fullest effect. It's digital video, film from the era, it's stills from the era, headlines of newspapers from all over Wisconsin, letters from people in Wisconsin to their nurses and doughboys at the front, and then letters back home from the front.
Right, and this is partly a World War One story. It's partly World War One through Wisconsin's eyes, right, John?
Absolutely. We wanted to really connect it, and we were fortunate enough to encounter people with the Historical Society and the Veterans Museum who were able to provide resources to us. And then, you know, just by serendipity, we ran into people who heard about what we were doing, who said, hey, I had a relative that fought in the war or died in the war or was a doctor in the war. And so we've been able to connect very directly and tell the stories of people, because this is much more about people and their experiences and getting caught up in this conflict than it is about you know, the politicians and the head states of Europe.
Now, this is a war that went on for about 3 years before the United States got directly involved. A lot of ambivalence in the United States in opposition to the idea. As I understand it, Wisconsin, first and foremost, was the last to embrace war fever. It, for many people, they never did, right?
Absolutely. And we have a strong focus. There's a segment of the show which is called The Traitor State, which really tries to encapsulate that debate and the prominent role of La Follette and Wisconsin's efforts to make people in the rest of the United States think twice about getting involved.
Talking to Sean Michael Dargan and John Wedge about a month of observances marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War One, among other things, a rock and roll history of the World War One era and Wisconsin's role in it. I understand you guys have a song to sing for us.
We do.
And a little excerpt from the show.
We do.
You set it up for us, Sean.
So this there was a ship, a famous ship, in the image of the Titanic, a huge luxury passenger liner called the Lusitania, British ship, and it was sunk in 1915 by a German U-boat. There were about 1,000 people that died on it. About a little over 100 of them were from the United States, some of them from Wisconsin, but it was one of the major argumental pillars of the push to then really get the United States to join the war on the side of the Allies. It didn't happen for a couple of years after the ship sank, but it was a pivotal moment.
All right, well, go ahead.
The song's called In the Belly of the Lusitania.
Island nation in desperate need of aid, with plea will Woodrow Wilson to help shatter this blockade. Torn up in wipers and in the Dardanelles, we need cheese and butter too, but mostly we need shells. The Hun will call this contraband, but wouldn't they love to take a look
in the belly of the Lusitania, the belly of the Lusitania. They will not know what else there is in the belly
Lusitania.
Of the Lusitania. Here's a man too proud to fight, who teeters on the brink. A ship too tough and much too fast to sink. Protect your ships as if our own, by any legal means, from prowling unrestricted submarines. The Hun would call this contraband, but wouldn't they love to take a look in the belly of the Lusitania,
Lusitania.
The belly of the Lusitania.
Lusitania.
Oh, the things you need we'll send to you in the belly
Lusitania.
Of the Lusitania.
False flags abound, and no cruiser rules of any type. Take down the Union Jack and
raise the stars and stripes. The southern coast of Ireland, the fog is slowly lifting. The patient German U-boat slowly drifting. The men drank brandy after lunch, still in their tuxedos. The ship was rocked by two huge blasts, but only one torpedo. 18 minutes it's down to the bottom of the sea, burying their secrets in the belly of the Lusitania. The belly of the Lusitania.
Lusitania.
Will we ever know just what there was in the belly of the Lusitania? The belly of the Lusitania. The belly of the Lusitania.
All right, and then what are we seeing? This is multimedia. You didn't bring it into the radio, which makes sense.
Wouldn't fit in the room, brother.
Right.
Giant video wall, 25 foot tall, with footage from 1915 of the Lusitania setting sail from New York.
Among other things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Now, this is the show. I want to touch on all the other stuff that's going on over this month of observances, John.
Absolutely. So what we were looking to do is make a really significant cultural footprint. We wanted there to be something for everybody. Our friend and colleague, Yvette Pino, who's at the Veterans Museum, has put together an incredible exhibition series across Madison. There's an opening tonight, for example, at the Graduate Hotel. It's been going on since actually gallery night, the beginning of October, goes right through the end of November. This is art by veterans, artists that she's brought in from around the country as well as from Wisconsin, and some high school kids actually. And we had a mini film series with Cinematheque as well as the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. So we had that. There's a play at the Overture Theatre on Monday, Ajax.
By Carthage College players,
yeah,
I think?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So a lot going on.
All right, and there's information, do I have this right, thegreatestwar.org, if people want to find info about
exactly,
all the events.
Exactly, exactly.
All right, well, John, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you.
And Sean, thank you, and thank you both for performing.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
We've been talking to Sean Michael Dargan and John Wedge. They're part of The Greatest War, a rock and roll history show commemorating the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. That's happening this Sunday night at the Barrymore Theater in Madison. It's a part of a month-long, as you were just hearing, of observances of the 100th anniversary of that armistice. Wisconsin is getting a dose of things to come, with snow and temperatures only hitting the 30s today. So wouldn't it be great to come home to a nice hot meal? Well, that's where slow cookers come in. Just dump the ingredients in the cooker, set it on low, and by the time you get back home, you got dinner. You probably have your go-to recipes if you use a slow cooker, but in this week's Food Friday, our guest is going to give us some new ones to try. Plus, she's got some slow cooking advice to help us get the best results. Amy Hanton is also known as the Cooking Mom. She blogs at cookingmom.com. That's thecookingmom.com, sorry. She's the author of The Cooking Mom Cookbooks and host of the TV cooking show Living with Amy out of Green Bay. Amy, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, my gosh, Rob, thanks for having me. And with this weather, I think that is absolutely time to talk about slow cooking recipes, don't you?
Definitely. I mean, I'm kind of an all-year slow cooker guy because you can cook on them and it doesn't heat up the kitchen in the summer that much. But, yeah, winter's definitely when it's prime time. How much do you use your slow cooker, especially this time of year?
You know what? It's I'm with you. It's kind of my lifesaver. It really is. As far as, you know, I'm a busy working mom, and I think that if we can all get up in the morning, dump everything in the slow cooker, and it just makes her life so much easier. I have a smile on my face all day long because I know when I walk in the door, I'm going to walk into the most, you know, amazing smelling home. And the best part is dinner's done, you know, and a lot of the slow cooker recipes I do, it's all in there. So you don't even need a side dish. I'm a huge fan of slow cooker liners. I think I need to be working for Reynolds because if you've not heard of these, Rob, you basically can get them at any grocery store, and you line your slow cooker with them, and then after dinner's done, you don't have to be scrubbing out the slow cooker. So those are a great, you know, lifesaver too. So dinner's done and no dishes. So you got to absolutely love that.
Yeah, those liners were new to me in reading your blog, actually, because, yeah, sometimes it's a pain to get there. There's like a line of stuff around the top of where everything was cooking. Any advice if we're not using a liner for easier cleanup?
Spray, you know, depending on what you're cooking, some slow cooker recipes are stickier than others. So I do like to spray my slow cooker with, you know, a cooking spray, a Tam or something like that, just really well, because sometimes you run out of liners or you don't have them on hand. But I have started buying them all the time. And it is one of those funny things. It's like people didn't know about them. And I hope, hopefully people are learning about them because they are a lifesaver. And now new they actually come in different sizes, so which is nice. I just noticed at the grocery store the other day, and they're about four to a pack. They're a couple bucks, but they have the smaller ones and the bigger ones, so they're awesome. They rock.
Now, when it comes to picking a slow cooker, it seems like there are a couple choices, you know, just the straight-up slow cooker, a crock pot. It's got a crock. And then some of them can be a slow cooker, but they have a thing at the bottom where you can brown meat first and then turn it to slow cooker. But that seems like it'd be hard to clean. I don't know. What do you think?
You know what? I tell you, the whole slow cooker thing has blown up. So there are so many different ones out there. And they can get really pricey, too. Those ones that brown are lovely because, you know, then you don't have to brown in a pan. And then some of my recipes call for, and if you have the time, like my Yankee pot roast, which we'll talk about that, if you have the time to brown your pork roast, your chicken breast, or your you know, beef roast just a little bit and then get it into your slow cooker, it's just going to give it that much flavor. A lot of my recipes, you don't need to do that, and sometimes we just don't have the time. So it's like, it's the morning. I don't have time to do that. I get it. But some of those are wonderful, but they're going to be a little more expensive. The one thing about slow cookers is they don't last forever. Sometimes the heating elements burn out. So I get questions and emails from people all the time, like, you know, I came home from work and it wasn't done. And it was there all, you know, 8-9 hours. Or it took it too far. Like, it took it way over the top. So, you know, you might be in the market for a new one, and you can get them now for like 15, 20 bucks. I do some work for a company called Nesto. You've heard of the Nesto Roasters. They're a Wisconsin company, Two Rivers, and they make, I love their slow cookers. They have a setting on them. They're very reasonable. They're under 50 bucks, and they actually have a setting on them where, let's say you're not home in 8 hours, you have a longer day, it'll immediately hold it at warm after 8 hours. Or when you're doing chicken in a slow cooker, like chicken breast, sometimes that's, you know, you don't want them to cook 8 hours because they would disintegrate and shred up to nothing. So you can hit the button for 4 hours. It'll cook it for 4 hours and then hold it to keep it warm. So that's something I do really love, is some of the slow cookers that have that digital, you know, digital read that you can program it, set it, and forget it. And those are still relatively inexpensive. I don't want to spend $100 on my slow cooker. I go to kids in college. I'd rather put my money somewhere else. So that's just me.
Talking to Amy Hanton, also known as the Cooking Mom. She's sharing advice on using a slow cooker. Good time of year for it. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question, or you can tell us about your favorite slow cooker dish. What do you look forward to making? And as Amy was saying, smelling when you come home from work. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Well, let's get cooking, Amy. You mentioned one of the recipes you shared with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday, the Yankee pot roast. Talk us through it.
You know, I'm ready for that rib stick and comfort food. It is just, there's nothing better than a pot roast. And I mentioned, if you do have the time to quickly brown up whatever you're putting in your slow cooker, a pork roast, a beef roast in this case, it just makes, you know, the depth of flavor in the slow cooker that much better. So this is one of my, you know, comfort food. All pot roasts are not created equal, though, so you're going to find a couple of different twists in my pot roast. One of them is, again, really seasoning your in this case, it's a chuck roast. My favorite type of, when I'm doing a pot roast, I really like a chuck roast because it's got the fat in there, and that's important. And it needs to braise low and slow. It's the perfect cut of meat, and they're inexpensive. So when you buy a chuck roast, get a big one. There's nothing worse than you've gone through the trouble of making a delicious pot roast, and at the end of it, there's no leftovers for a hot beef sandwich. When you're slow cooking, remember, it cooks low and slow, and it tends to shrink down a little bit. So get a good 5-pound boneless chuck roast, or bone-in, but normally they're boneless, or get two of them. Get 2 3-pounders, 2.5 3-pounders, and throw them both in your slow cooker. Season the heck out of them. It's a big piece of meat. I like to use garlic salt and black pepper and quite a bit of it. Then I throw in there, after I've browned it, just a couple of minutes on each side with a little bit of oil in like a big skillet. Dump those roasts in your slow cooker with 2 cans of cream of mushroom soup, a cup of water, and a couple cups of beef stock. Also a couple tablespoons of tomato paste. Now, in the old days when we were doing pot roast, we just, you know, throw that pot roast in there with some water. And it just doesn't give it a lot of great flavor. So these days we like to kick things up and take things to another level. So when you're slow cooking, think about doing instead of water, beef stock. Think about adding, you know, maybe some beer, some wine. You know, there's no beer or wine in this recipe, but if you wanted to throw a little bit of dry red wine or dry Chardonnay wine in there, you know, do it. It's just going to enhance the flavor. But the tomato paste is also going to kind of take that gravy to a whole other level. Just a couple tablespoons of that. You can also throw in some onions, some carrots, some celery. I love those. And just put the lid on it. Let it cook slow and slow all day long. Pot roast needs 8 hours, you know, to just really fall apart on you. And this is going to be one of the best pot roasts you've ever had. If you want to thicken the gravy at the very end, you can take some of the juice and do a little bit of water and cornstarch or beef stock and cornstarch or even red or white wine and cornstarch. Make a little slurry, whisk that together, and then dump it in your slow cooker and then turn it on high for just maybe 15, 20 minutes, and that'll thicken the gravy a little bit. But I'm getting hungry just thinking about this.
Yeah.
So now I'm craving pot roast. Thanks a lot, Rob. Really appreciate that.
Yeah. Oh, I always get hungry this time of the week on Food Friday. Now, I'll often want, of course, potatoes in with the pot roast or whatever I'm making. I want to run this by you. I encountered this once. It may matter what kind of potatoes, because one time I tried Yukon Golds and cooking on low all day, and they never really exactly cooked like you want a potato to be cooked. Does it matter? Do you have to be picky about which kind of potatoes you throw in?
You know, that's weird. Did you throw them in? I wonder if they were really big, because one thing I try and think about is the vegetables you're putting in there, you know, should kind of be the same size. So next time I would maybe cut them up a little bit.
All right.
But they should, or maybe, Rob, you're one of the people who needs a slow cooker. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I don't know. but it should cook all, you know, they should get nice and tender. Yukon Golds do take a little bit longer than, like, the baby reds and your, you know, regular, you know, russet potatoes. So, but chew them up a little bit. You don't need to peel the potatoes, though. I mean, that's just kind of a pain, and I really love the rusticness. Just wash them really well. But also the other thing is that if you like your potatoes to have, you know, not be really, really mushy, sometimes I'll put those in toward the end. So let's say that your roast cooks all day long, and you get home, you've got a couple hours. Let's say you get home from work at about 4, you know, wishful thinking. But, and you're going to do the laundry and, you know, work on your email. You can actually throw the vegetables in the last couple hours and crank that roast up to high, and then your vegetables won't be quite as you know, mushy, I guess, if you like your vegetables to be a little bit firmer. But potatoes do need a good couple of hours in there, so I hope that helps.
We're getting the most out of our slow cookers with The Cooking Mom, Amy Hanton. She blogs at thecookingmom.com. She's also a cookbook author and host of the TV cooking show Living with Amy out of Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you use your slow cooker? What is your favorite recipe? What's your favorite thing to make in the slow cooker or to eat when somebody else makes it, especially during these fall and winter months? And what questions do you have about cooking with the slow cooker? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We've got recipes from Amy, by the way, Yankee Pot Roast, Just Leave It, Beef and Wine, and Triple Chocolate Mess, posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page and WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. We're firing up our slow cookers with Amy Hanton, a.k.a. The Cooking Mom, on this edition of Food Friday. She blogs at thecookingmom.com. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite slow cooker recipe? Call 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. We've got Stephanie on the line in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hello. I love this topic. I use my slow cooker a couple times a week this time of year, and I love a slow cooker for soup. And my favorite go-to is a really easy loaded potato soup. Night before, I usually do all my prep, so peel a bunch of potatoes, throw them in a crock pot with some chicken broth, usually enough to cover the potatoes, some chopped garlic, onions, salt and pepper. In the morning, I'll put it in the slow cooker, let it go all day, and then when I get home, I throw in a block of cream cheese, mash up the potatoes, add a little milk, and then you top it with bacon, cheese, sour cream. It's divine.
Heavy duty. Stephanie, thanks a lot for that. And I've heard this, Amy, if you're using dairy in your recipes, add them not at the beginning, but toward the end. Does Stephanie have that right?
I agree with that in some of my recipes for sure. And boy, that sounds amazing. And I love the idea of cream cheese in there. And I love the idea of doing soups in your slow cooker. We're a soup family. My daughter, that's her favorite thing, is soup. I just don't have time to, you know, for all day soups. My soups have to happen in like 20 minutes or less, or I do them in my slow cooker. I do a cheesy broccoli soup that's out of this world. I do a potato sausage and cheese chowder that's the ultimate game day food. It'd be perfect for the Packers game this weekend. And in fact, that recipe was actually featured in the New York Times. It's the ultimate football food. It's got beer,
nice.
It's got Wisconsin cheese and sausage and potatoes, and it's one of my all-time favorites. So if you're looking for a new slow cooker soup recipe, please check that one out. My sausage and cheese chowder is to die for.
That sounds great, Stephanie. Thanks for the call. We'll go now to Mark in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to ask about, Mark?
Well, I would like to know the difference in between a slow cooker and a pressure pot.
Mark,
I was brought up with a pressure pot, and, you know, economically, it's much cheaper.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. So slow cookers, pressure pots, or pressure cookers, I will throw Instapots into the mix. Amy, compare and contrast.
Yeah, they're completely different. And that whole instant pressure cooker, you know, also known the brand for it is Instapot, but I know my folks in Nesco at In Two Rivers make an instant pressure cooker. They are all the rage right now, and they're completely different than slow cookers. Instant pressure cookers cook fast. They use pressure. And, you know, people love them. People swear by them. I'm trying to do more and more recipes in these instant pressure cookers because people want them. But slow cookers are completely different. They are more affordable, and they cook things low and slow, and you can't really speed them up. You know, they just got a couple of settings. So they are different. They're both wonderful, though, in different ways.
All right, hope that helps sort things out for you. We'll go now to Rob in Stevens Point. Rob, hello.
Hello. Having grown up on the south side of Milwaukee, both the wife and I always referred to it as pot roast and box kartoffels for the potatoes and carrots. Have
box kartoffels is what you call the part with the potatoes and carrots?
Correct.
Is there a box of anything involved in it?
No. Box kartoffels. It's just
all one word.
All one word.
Okay.
How do you spell it?
Yeah, how do you spell that, Rob? I'm trying to sort it out.
I've never tried to spell it. It's just what grandma and mom and everybody used to call them.
All right. I'll throw that out to our listeners if you've encountered this idea of box kartoffels, 800-642-1234, or call in anything slow cooker related. But that's pretty classic. Meat, carrots, and potatoes in some form, Amy, in the crock pot together.
It is. And, you know, that's so cute. I love that. And I love family, you know, sayings. We all have family things that call different food, different things. And I just love that. Rutabaga is also wonderful. Try putting some different things with your pot roast. If you're a mushroom person, I love mushrooms. Put the mushrooms, like whole button mushrooms, in the last hour and a half of cooking your pot roast. Throw some fresh herbs in there. That's a great way to take a recipe to a whole another level. Toward the end of the cooking, you know, chop some fresh rosemary, some parsley, some fresh thyme, and that is a way to just kick up whatever you're cooking, you know, especially, you know, beef, pot roast, pork. I just have so many fun slow cooker recipes on my website and in both my cookbooks, and I'm posting new ones all the time because people want them. You know, they want to take their slow cooker recipes to the next level.
And Michelle Good in the studio with me has already solved the conundrum here. Kartoffel, the German word for potato, of course, on the south side of Milwaukee. Also reminds me how I've wasted my 20 credits of college German. So I think it's box kartoffel. So I don't know the first part there, but kartoffel, that's the potato part. And maybe if I go back, I'll remember that carrot sounds something like the first part there. So there we go. Let's go to dessert in just a moment as we're talking to Amy Hanton, the cooking mom. We are cooking with slow cookers. A lot of recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. You got a dessert for us. I love the sound of this triple chocolate mess. I got to say, you had me at triple chocolate mess. Tell us about this one.
Rob, this is my daughter. So when, you know, the kids have sleepovers, I used to love to make something really special when they had friends over to spend the night. And
there's nothing better when you get a call from the kid's mom the next day, like, what did you serve for dessert? And you end up looking like a total rock star and you're asking for the recipe. So this is that recipe. There's so much you can do in your slow cooker. I do slow cooker oatmeal. I do slow cooker breakfast recipes. Your Thanksgiving side dish recipes. Do those in the slow cooker to free up oven space. I make a killer slow cooker stuffing, mashed potatoes, mac and cheese. But dessert in your slow cooker is amazing. Now, this is a chocolate lover's dream. Both my kids are chocoholics, and so am I. I think that the apple didn't fall far from the tree. But it's so easy. You basically take a box of chocolate cake mix and mix it together with sour cream, instant chocolate pudding. So don't make the pudding. You just want to use the dry mix. Oil, 4 eggs, water, and 2 cups of chocolate chips. You mix that all together. Make sure you line or spray your slow cooker really well. Yeah. This is a sticky mess. And basically, you cook it for a few hours. It's not a cake. It's like a soupy, chocolatey, yummy mess. It really is a mess. And you basically serve it warm with vanilla ice cream, maybe some whipped cream, and some chocolate syrup over the top. And it is the ultimate movie night in, sleepover kids dessert. It's just a decadent and it's amazing.
This is eat with a spoon, not a finger food, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Now, do you go for multiple slow cookers at the same time? Because you're talking about doing a lot of different stuff with them. Do you sometimes have two or three fired up at once?
Totally. I mean, first of all, I'm a huge Packers fan. So game day parties, I do not want to be in the kitchen the whole time. That stinks. So I don't want to miss anything. So I put my whole game day spread out on my kitchen island, and everybody can help themselves. So you betcha. I have chilies in my slow cooker. And another one, I've got my, French dip sandwich or my green chili pork roast that people can shred up and make their own burrito. So I have multiple slow cookers. I also do a lot of great dips in slow cookers. I do a buffalo chicken wing dip in my slow cooker that is a hit at every game day party. So I have all sorts of different sizes, all sorts of different colors. You can never have too many slow cookers, right?
Okay. Now, you got to give me a pep talk, Amy, because I use my slow cooker a lot, and I basically always do exactly the same thing in chicken and something else. Maybe it's salsa for tacos or, Hungarian spices for chicken paprikash or something like that. Get me to broaden my horizons. I've done a few different things, but I always go back to the same darn thing.
First of all, I got to share a recipe that's near and dear to my heart that you have to try it, and it's perfect with the holidays coming up. I call it my Just Leave It Beef and Wine, and there's a story behind it. My grandmother was an amazing cook. She loved to entertain, and when she passed away, I found this handwritten recipe, and I had her lipstick stain on it.
Said,
this is the go-to at my dinner parties, and it was called Just Leave It Beef and Wine. And I can literally picture her, getting this all together and just leaving it and having a glass of wine herself and then setting the table and putting her lipstick on and getting ready for a dinner party. When she entertained, she did it simple, and made it wonderful. And I think so many people these days get caught up in doing a million different dishes. You don't have to do that. Just do a few dishes. This was her go-to. And I make it every holiday season. People rave about it. And basically, it's about 3 to 4 pounds of chuck roast trimmed of some of the fat, cut into good 2 to 3 inch chunks. And then a can of cream of mushroom soup, a cream of celery soup, and cream of chicken soup. It sounds weird, go with it. 1 packet of dry onion soup mix and a boatload, a good couple of cups of a dry red wine. Nothing real expensive, Merlot, Cabernet. Mix it all together. Put it in your slow cooker. She did it in her oven because we're talking, this was way before slow cooker. She would cover it, do it, in her oven.
And Amy, I'm going to have to jump in. We are all out of time, but if you want to try that recipe, we do have it at WPR.org/Food Friday. Thanks to Amy Hanton, the cooking mom. She blogs at thecookingmom.com. You can get that recipe and two others. We've got two beef dishes for the slow cooker and one chocolatey dessert. You can find them all at WPR.org/Food Friday and still share your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, speaking of chocolate, on Monday, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine is back with us to talk about humankind's love affair with chocolate. Turns out it goes back way further than we thought. Well, also, in the days since Halloween, some Wisconsin Public Radio employees are developing mixed feelings about chocolate. Producer J. Carlisle Larson is in the house. Hey, JC.
Hello.
So we get this wave of Halloween candy that people couldn't give away at their houses.
Yeah, we are, I think, a treat-centric network. People bring things in all the time, and you better believe that people have just showered us with candy ever since Halloween. But as much as I love candy, I am done.
You are done. There were mini size, really tiny sized candy bars. I ate probably 1.5 full size candy bars worth of them today. You contributed to the glut.
I did. I'm trying to hide my guilt, but I did buy a bunch of candy for our election night coverage, which in hindsight was a huge mistake. I've had to since hide the remainder of the chocolate because I think we're all going to get sick at this point by eating, not mentioning a brand name, peanut butter cups.
Right. And I have this habit sometimes, especially this time you're walking by people's offices and kind of getting a little side eye, seeing, is there any candy there?
Yeah. I mean, I think that everyone does that.
All right. We're trying to break the habit. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.